Blog Talk Radio. Good evening. You are listening to the Words on Flicks show on eWater Radio, KEWRDB. Welcome, welcome. It's me, your host, music journalist, blogger, and movie fan, Janine Coveney, for another edition of the Words on Flicks show, movie talk from a fan perspective. I'm really excited about tonight's show because it gives me an opportunity to talk about the two things that I'm most interested in, music and film, with one of my best colleagues who also likes to talk about music and film. Tonight's show continues the Words on Flicks series that I've been doing in May, looking at various film genres. And if you listened last week, you heard that I talked about film noir. But tonight, we're going to visit a very, very different and more contemporary film genre. We're looking at the biographical picture, otherwise known as the biopic. People, please stop saying biopic when you're talking about these type of movies. It's a biopic. Anyway, these real-life stories about the experiences, struggles, and triumphs of living folks have been Hollywood gold for decades. There's nothing like a true-to-life story. And so I was inspired to do this show because the much-anticipated new film about Elton John called Rocketman is opening nationwide tomorrow, May 31st. Woo-hoo! If I could have seen the film tonight, I would have. They are showing it this evening, but then I wouldn't be able to do the show, Words on Flicks Live, and talk to you. So tonight, we're going to take a look at the specific subcategory, the musical biopic. So the reason why I'm super, super excited about this is because joining me for this discussion is a very, very special guest, my dear friend, esteemed colleague, Mr. A. Scott Galloway, joining me from Los Angeles. So before I open the mic, let me give you a little bit of his professional bio, and I'm sure he's listening and chuckling along. But Scott Galloway, A. Scott Galloway, is no joke, y'all. He's a prolific Los Angeles-based music journalist who's been writing about music since 1988. For magazines that include Urban Network, which is what he's most known for, Wax Poetics, and the UK's Blues and Soul magazine. And he has interviewed artists, every kind of artist, from Max Roach to Maxwell. And that's just a short explanation of who he's interviewed, everybody, y'all. His specialty, though, is composing liner notes essays for reissues and compilations of classic recordings, for which he has written more than 300 of them. Okay, so if you have any kind of compilation, CD collection in your collection, he probably wrote the liner notes, okay? As it relates to history in black film, though, those credits include the 25th anniversary deluxe 2-CD reissue of Curtis Mayfield's Superfly, the Real R-E-E-L Quincy Jones compilation of the composer-conductor's film music, the Best of Shaft compilation of songs and cues from the Shaft film trilogy, the Golden Era Motown time capsule Coolie High, a pairing of Gladys Knight and the Pips Claudine with Pipe Dreams, those two albums together, and the various artist compilations Super Bad on Celluloid. Mr. Galloway is also the editor of the 2013 Hal Leonard Deluxe Coffee Table book, Down the Roads, the Fender Rhodes story. And he wrote the foreword for Les McCann's book of photography, invitation to openness. So I'm really pleased as punch to welcome my brother from Los Angeles, Mr. A. Scott Galloway, to the Words on Flick show. And Scott, hey, how you doing, brother?
Good evening, my dear, dear friend, Miss Coveney. I've been looking forward to this ever since you asked me, and the time has arrived. So let's do our thing, baby. I'm looking forward to it.
Let's do our thing, because, y'all, if you're listening, and you, as you can probably tell, Scott and I have been friends for a long time. I lived in Los Angeles for a long time, and Scott and I, you know, we've seen a lot of movies together. We've seen a lot of concerts together as friends, and we would always chop it up afterwards talking about movies, and particularly the music biopic, you know, which is sort of our area of expertise, really incited some of the most, I'd say, animated conversations between us, because we've both covered music for a long, long time, and I know, Scott, you have a lot of strong opinions about these films.
Yes, I do.
So, Rocket... Yes. So Rocket Man comes out tomorrow for most of us. So let me just preface this by saying that Elton John, and I was trying to say this last week, Elton John was one of my musical inspirations as a kid, because, or I would say 18, because I was into playing the piano and writing songs. So it was like he and Bernie Taupin, I just love their music and the lyrics. So I'm really looking forward to seeing this movie. Do you have any expectations for the film?
Well, you know, I've always liked Elton. He's not been as much of a favorite of mine as I think he is of yours. He's always had songs throughout the years and decades that really touch me. I know certain things about him, but there's, you know, I'm certainly a lot that I don't know. But the reason why I'm really looking forward to this movie is because, for once, you know, he, as the actual artist being covered in the movie, had a hand, you know, a very big hand in shaping the way it's presented. And, you know, we both read that wonderful article that he penned himself for the Guardian paper, and, you know, spoke about what it was like to actually prepare to have his life, you know, on screen, and, you know, how much of it he wanted to share, how much of it he didn't, how much of it he felt needed to be hard, fast biography, and the fact that he was also open to having other elements be more phantasmagorical, I guess, fantasy elements, which in some cases for me I would have a problem with, but because Elton was such an over-the-top performer and superstar and so colorful and all that, it's like, as long as we have that balance of getting some real Elton and as well as, you know, some I don't want to use the word fabricated, but, you know, just, you know, some exaggerated, you know, imaginative spins on who he is, who he felt he was, and who he thinks people think he is. I think it's going to be just an exceptional ride in the movie theater. So I'm really looking forward to it.
I'm looking forward to it as well, because, as you rightly point out, Elton was a very you know, on stage, he was very flamboyant. He had these costumes. He, you know, his imagination, his style of performing was really sort of over the top in some ways, but also very down to earth in other ways, and very poetic and lyrical. And I think that certainly lends to these fantastic elements coming out in the film. And I think that's going to be very much like him. And so I was actually on the Paramount Pictures site looking at some of their material, and so they had an interview with Elton. It was 8 minutes long, but here's just a short soundbite of what he had to say about the film. So let's listen in. I think it takes a minute.
Cool.
To
if I was going to do a movie of my life, or someone was going to do it, I didn't want to do a biopic. And my life's been fairly crazy. I mean, it covers from when I was a kid to 1990, when I went into rehab and came out of rehab. So, I mean, my life when I started to become famous became really, really extraordinary and kind of surrealistic. And that's how I kind of wanted the film to be. I mean, I wanted it to be fun, and I wanted it not to take itself too seriously. And for me, it was important also musically played. The music was my life, so that was the most important thing, getting the music right, because the songs in the film are integral to the story.
So he says the music is integral to the story, and of course, when you're doing a musical biopic, you really can't separate it, because that's what the audience wants. They want to see how the artist came up with the music and how the music fits into aspects of that person's life. So
absolutely, and I think one of the things that's going to be really special about this movie as well is the fact that even though Elton is the foreground star, you know, he wrote all of those songs with the amazing Bernie Taupin. So there's this friendship, you know, bromance, you know, story of how they collaborate, and you know, Bernie's straight, Elton's gay. They both have their own love lives and all that, but they write these amazing songs together, and together and not together, because, you know, we've been reading that, you know, Bernie writes in one room, or, you know, off in his world, and then Elton writes the music in his world, and just kind of, Elton always felt that he knew exactly how to score, I guess, Bernie's lyrics, and together they create this thing. So I'm really interested in that aspect of it, because, you know, the superstar performer and all that stuff is always, that's going to be a lot of fun to watch. But as a musicologist and a historian, music journalist, whatever you want to call what you and I do, it's, you know, I'm really fascinated by craft and relationships,
yeah,
of people that do things together, you know, create things together. So That's probably the aspect of the film I'm most looking forward to, is getting some insight into their relationship as friends and collaborators.
Absolutely, because, you know, on the face of it, this is going to be the sort of the classic story of how an artist started, you know, started small, you know, got big, got famous, indulged in excesses, almost lost everything, and came back from the brink. So that's like just the, you know, that's the stamp, that's the formula for how a lot of these rock biopics go. But it's really going to be these little details of how he overcame, and the relationships, and really how he was able to be creative. And I think that, you know, and we'll get into this as well, but one thing that distinguishes this from Bohemian Rhapsody, which was the Freddie Mercury Queen film from just a couple of months ago, is that the star Taron Egerton actually, let me say his name better, Taron Egerton actually sings. And Elton was really pleased with the way that Taron sang these songs, apparently.
Yeah, well, it was important to him that the whoever was going to play the role could actually sing. And though Rami Malek in Bohemian Rhapsody did how do you pronounce his name?
Yeah, Rami Malek. You said it right.
Oh, I said it right. Okay. Yeah, so yeah, that he lip-synced, but he did, you know, it was an incredible performance. I really enjoyed, in fact, all four of the guys that played the members of Queen in that movie. My problems with that film were more to do with what was not told in the story, and how they kind of whitewashed a lot of the story, and which is not going to be the case with Rocket Man, which is an R-rated film, and Bohemian Rhapsody, which was, you know, PG-13, which was almost a deterrent for me when I found out just of what I did know about Freddie Mercury. But again, that film was, you know, it was one that I enjoyed the musical aspects, you know, the origins behind the songs and the big gigantic performances in concert. And as I said, the performances acting wise of the four guys, four Queen members. But the story really kind of, you know, laid an egg for me. But I think that Rocket Man will be 180 degree difference from that.
And it's interesting because, you know, one of the things, you know, there's pros and cons to doing a biopic while the subject is still alive. And here you would think that if the subject is still alive, that person would want to fudge some of the uglier parts of their history. They would want to whitewash, you know, and just focus on the good. And Elton hasn't done that. And I think Taron Egerton, in what he was talking about, and I know you haven't seen it, but he kind of hinted at the fact that since Elton came out of rehab, some of that, what he went through and the therapy that he went through, it's just like a whole new level of openness and honesty about who he is has come to the fore, and that helped him make the movie. And also, he didn't hover over the production while they were making it, which is also key, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, he had mad respect for the filmmakers and the fact that he had a hand in it. You know, he didn't feel like he had to overstep and like you said, hover. You know, he was happy. I mean, it certainly wasn't going to get done without his involvement, but he let the filmmakers do what they do. And so it's another reason why I'm going into the theater to see it with mad respect for Elton to allow it to happen, because I think that,
yeah,
you know, again, to Bohemian Rhapsody, the group and family members and everything were so precious about Freddie's story and the fact that he wasn't here to say yay or nay about how deep they wanted to go into his personal life and things. So, you know, but Elton's here, and unlike, you know, this even goes to biographies, books that we read. You know, there's certain books that come out, and you read them, and you're just like, you know, you want to throw them out the window because you know that the person just said, you know, they scrapped this, they tore chapters out, they edited and censored, and, you know, and nobody that already knows a little something about those people is believing this story, and you're disappointed. So, you know, if you're going to do these things, at the bottom line is, you know, go ahead and give up the phone. You know, you don't have to tell everything, but it's like, please don't try to make it something that people that know better are not going to believe. That's the key thing. And it's deep, because so many people see movies and they won't read books. So they'll see the movie and assume that what they're seeing, it was in the movie. That's how it went down in the movie. So that's the person's real story. They're not going to bother to read the book. So, you know, I feel like they should be as on point as possible.
And that's, you know, that was another point that I was going to bring up, because people like you and me who know better and have sometimes the inside track of having been in the industry and watching these people and reading all the developments as they happened a lot of times, I think the general audience doesn't really know these details, as you say, and sometimes they don't care, and that can become maddening. They're like, I don't care, I like the music, you know, he looked, you know. He looked like Elton John, and that becomes way more important to them, I think. And then even the conversation, you know, as we get into, so the next part of our conversation, I wanted to talk about, you know, some of the elements that make good biopics, and one of them was casting, and we keep bumping up against this issue of every time we hear about a new movie, well, so-and-so doesn't even look like the main character, and sometimes that's important, and sometimes it isn't, because it's acting. Like, where do you fall on that, Scott?
You know, it all comes back to the story for me, for the most part. It's like, I really do think that, you know, with today's makeup and wardrobe and wigs and technology and everything, that you can get a decent actor to look close enough to the person that they're covering so that it's not ridiculous. But then again, you know, I saw some trailers for this Bobby DeBarge movie that's about to come out on television, and everybody has been bashing the wigs or whatever they did for his Jerry Curl hair, whatever his hairstyle is. People are like, what the hell happened there? You know, but generally speaking, yeah, I mean, I want the person to look like them, but it's more important for the performance to be great. And the look has to be in the ballpark, because when we go back a few years to that debate about Nina Simone, and they had this woman that just looked nothing like Nina. Now that doesn't work, you know, because if you're sitting there in the audience and you know anything about Nina, you're not able to get into the story because you're looking at someone that's not allowing you to sink into the fact that, okay, I'm buying that you're Nina. right now, you know, and that just ruins the whole point of doing the movie, you know. It doesn't work for me.
I feel you on that. So some of the things that I thought were important to biopics, and then we can get into talking about some of our favorites, is indeed the casting. And also, I think what's really, really key, and I'm skipping over a couple of things, but of course the film score and the soundtrack and how that's produced is really going to help the viewers connect with the artist. You know, the music has to be there, whether it is recreated music or it's the original soundtrack. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's tough. Like I said, at least in the Queen movie, I guess he was lip syncing to actual Queen performances, if
yeah.
I remember correctly. So, you know, that worked for me, again, because the actor was so phenomenal that, you know, he's looking like Freddie and all the mannerisms, and I'm hearing Freddie in my ears on the soundtrack. That works. But, you know, that doesn't always have to be the case. Sometimes you can have some really good re-recordings that work, but I've seen cases where it, you know, it didn't work for me. We had talked a little bit earlier, and I was saying something about the Temptations musical, which is so dazzling and wonderful on the surface, and then I had some problems with scripting. But the other problem I had was those records, particularly when you get to the Norman Whitfield era. I mean, horns, strings, orchestration with rhythm and wah-wah guitar, 3-4 guitars going on. They couldn't reproduce that with the house band that they had on stage. So as a Temptations fan, that was a big letdown for me. Now, a lot of people, you know, as long as they get the general melody and groove and the basic flourishes of the song, it works for them. But for me, you know, those records were so amazing. I know every intricate detail. So when it's not right, I'm, you know, it turns my head to the left. And again, takes me out of being able to enjoy the story or just go with it, because I'm like, man, this don't sound nothing like Papa Was a Rolling Stone, you know? So, yeah, music
exactly.
is very important. You got to get it right. Got to get it right.
Exactly. And that's why I'm looking forward to The Rocket Man, to see how Taron Egerton does, because, you know, when you have certain expectations of a particular style and sound of music, people like you and I can be like, oh man, this is so disappointing. It's like you come in hungry for a great meal and they're giving you scraps and you're just like left wanting. So with that in mind, you know, I've got a list of some of the films that we thought did well in the biopic arena and some that were more problematic. So I wanted to start with Ray from 2004, the Ray Charles story. And we both thought that that was pretty well done. Do you think it's because of the casting of Jamie Foxx?
I think there's a couple of things that were really good about Ray. The casting, Jamie did a fantastic job and had access to Ray Charles just before Ray passed. So he got that good hands-on, you know, study of who Ray was. He also got, you know, Ray's nod of approval and everything. So he was able to go into that performance with all the confidence that an actor really needs to feel if they're going to portray somebody as iconic as Ray Charles. Taylor Hackford's direction was wonderful. And the other thing that was really good about Ray is that they didn't try to tell his entire life story. They told a good chunk of it, most of it, you know, but, you know, they started from childhood and they took it to a certain point and then they left it there. And so even though I know that film ran over 2 hours, you know, you didn't feel like you were left wanting. You know, basically you knew that after that, when the movie story ended, that Ray went on and was just, you know, the great Ray Charles till the day he died, and, you know, still performed and still charmed people and everything. So you felt like his story was pretty well told. And even the other casting was great. The Ray Letts and you know, I mean, that was
Regina King.
One of those magical films. Yeah. One of the few times that they really, just about every element I felt in Ray was right, and that's rare.
Yeah, and you know, they really captured him at a time when I feel like there was a lot of, you know, because Ray Charles kind of came from another era. Like, he probably had his biggest heyday in the 50s and 60s, and so there was a segment of the audience that might not have known him as well, although there was, you know, some talk about him in the news at that time. But it also came out at exactly the right time, I think. So that helped it. And Jamie Foxx just has
well
a
known.
Really. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, just like you know, like one of those. And I didn't mean to cut you off, but it's like he was. Even if you didn't know Ray Charles songs, I think just because of who he was, the blind black singer. You know, at the piano, you know, you got the right one. Yeah, he was in commercials. He, you know, he had done so many other things that branded, you know, and gave people an idea of who he was. And there was always in the last years of his life that thing of the genius, you know, the great Ray Charles.
Yeah.
You know, you better bow down. This is the cat, you know. So, you know, everybody knew that, oh, we're watching this movie because, you know, they made this movie about him because he deserves it. You know, he's a legend. And I'm going to sit here and learn something about this cat, you know.
And it was also an amazing story. I mean, just to lose your sight as a child and to achieve as much as he achieved is a great inspirational story in and of itself. So it was just really well done, a great mix of story and music and, as you said, a chunk of his life that we could relate to. So,
yeah,
and
you could see him as a human being, as a businessman, as a husband, as a, you know, player, as a, you know, a great musician, and all the different lives that came through his life, and Quincy Jones, and,
right.
You know, he was part of the big, that great era of black Hollywood, you know, black superstars, and then, of course, him being blind as well, you get to see, you know, the behind-the-scenes stuff about how he maneuvered and how he could do things that you wouldn't think a blind man would be able to do, you know, how he was so independent. You know, so there were aspects that went above and beyond his stardom and his musicality that were also intriguing. You know, again, that Taylor, you know, he had a great subject to work with, and they did a great job with it.
Absolutely. And kudos to Jamie, because I think Jamie's process, like, he really has a way of inhabiting, you know, he's acting, but he's also doing like these perfect. I don't know if you saw the Jeffersons when he played George Jefferson on TV. Like, you know, he really had all the mannerisms down, and it was so amazing. So
yeah,
anyway, but I want to move on.
Yeah, that's
yeah,
one of his calling
ahead.
Cards. I did not see the Jeffersons. I didn't see the Jeffersons thing. I just didn't watch it. I was afraid that I was not going to like it. But maybe I'll, if it was a DVR of it or something, I'll check it out. But yeah, Jamie is an actor, but he's also a comedian, also an impersonator, master impersonator.
An impersonator.
And he, mm-hmm. Yeah, he can do more than just, you know, the voice. He gets all the tics, like you said, all the mannerisms, the walk, the talk, the head, you know, any movements. I mean, anything that was a signature of who Ray was, you know, Jamie didn't miss a lick.
And he's a musician, so that's important. But let's move on, because we have to talk about
okay.
What's Love Got to Do with It, which is the Tina Turner story from 1993.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that
amazing.
Angela
Bassett
is phenomenal, okay, because she doesn't really look like Tina, but she really approximated her style, her approach, her look. Like, Tina had a really, really physical approach on stage, and you really saw, you know, that she was a country girl who could belt, and how she became this sophisticated R&B performer, but at the same time, she was being abused. And that's a hard story to tell and a hard story to watch. So it is really inspiring to see. And it was Tina's own story that she told herself, adapted to the screen.
Yeah, that's right. So that was another case where, you know, the artist was alive, they had a hand in it. And I think she definitely, you know, part of her triumph, you know, was to be able to have, you know, her story told like that. I mean, for all the hell that she went through, you know, at the end of the day, she was the one that, you know, was the superstar. She was the one that had the clout to have a movie made about her life, which of course had to include Ike. And, but, you know, she got to have that story told her way, you know, and not his way. There was some controversy about that from people that are, you know, Ike Turner supporters and fans, mm-hmm. and his family and all that. It felt like he might have gotten a bit more of a raw deal than he deserved. But this is way before the Me Too movement. And it was one of those things, one of those stories that just resonated so much, I would imagine, you know, with women and, mm-hmm. and, you know, and anybody that came, you know, off from that particular era, when you remember how songs were written and how female artists were produced, and so many of the songs were, you know, oh, I love my man unconditionally and this, that, and the other. And, you know, here's Tina Turner comes, this firebrand, and, you know, just, you know, a mercury, you know, whirl on the stage. But was still, even with all of that, you know, dealing with abuse and disrespect off of the stage. And but yeah, that was a great film. And you also have to, of course, give mad props to Lawrence Fishburne, because he did a hell of a job as Ike as well. You had a tandem there of two people that played the hell out of their roles, and you know, and just mm-hmm. and great source material to work with. Amazing film.
Exactly. Just watching these two actors, you know, really do some of their best work, to the point where, you know, women wanted to like slap Lawrence Fishburne. You know? It's like, I'll make you eat the cake. You know, it's like,
right?
Hey, this is called acting. And I think, you know, people didn't necessarily know the depths of what she had dealt with in her life. So, again, it was an inspiring story with a great central performance. And I could see where, you know, I could feel that he was overlooked, because his story is actually an amazing story. I mean, he was a big star with some amazing records before Tina even came into the picture. And I don't think people really know the role that he played in rock and roll. But I digress. We're talking about
this
film.
Yeah, that was the unfortunate thing. That's why I said in the beginning that, you know, Tina was the icon, and she was able to tell her story, which included his story, but it certainly wasn't going out of its way to tell the fact that he was, you know, a pioneer of rock and roll. You know, a lot of people consider Rocket 88 to be one of the very first rock and roll songs, if not the first. And, you know, what a driving band leader he was, and all of that. I mean, it just kind of felt like they demonized him and didn't show enough of what was amazing and great about Ike. So, you know, Ike deserves his props. I don't know if he'll ever get a movie, but maybe there should be a documentary done about him that really gets into his music mastery and what he forged, you know, that set the pave, mm-hmm. that, you know, paved the way for rock and roll and rhythm and blues.
Absolutely. Now, I know one of the films that you also brought up when we were talking about Well Done was Walk the Line from 2005 about Johnny Cash. And to be honest, I had not seen the whole thing. So I actually watched it today.
Okay.
So it's, yeah, with Joaquin Phoenix as Johnny Cash and Reese Witherspoon mm-hmm. as June Carter. And I enjoyed it because, honestly, I didn't know that much about Johnny Cash. I don't know how truthful it is. So this is a situation where I'm like the audience. I don't really know all the detail. I know some of his music, you know, but I'm being, mm-hmm. You know, I'm watching this film, and as a piece of film, I thought it was interesting because it's used a flashback kind of setup, and then you kind of see these snapshots of his his early life, and then you kind of get into more of how he grew his career to until he performed at the prison. And I thought it was well done. So what?
Yeah, that's one of those films to me that was almost like a painting. It's like a portrait of him. And again, I didn't feel like it was warts and all, you know, top to bottom. It was just a really nice portrait of who Johnny Cash is, what he represents to American music and Americana and American mythology and all of that. You know, the man in black. And like you, I only have a few of Johnny's albums, and I don't know his history inside out. But I really like the rhythm of that movie, and I always remember the way it opens. I mean, because I'm a drummer as well, and there's just this long shot of them going into that prison, and you just hear the band vamping on this very simple country groove, and it gets louder and louder as they get closer and closer, and you're coming in onto the stage. And I just remember sitting in the theater, like, I was so excited. You know, it was just, it really set me up to get into the movie, because it was starting off with him already being Johnny Cash, and he's about to play for Folsom Prison, and everybody's there, and they can't wait to see him. Such a great opening for a film. And I really liked Joaquin and Reese's performances of Johnny and Rose was June. Thank you. June Carter, Cash, June Carter Cash. Yeah. And it's just amazing. But yeah, like I said, if there were inaccuracies, they probably went by me because I didn't know his story enough to be able to say.
Now, see, that puts us in a situation of, like, the general audience, exactly, like, when we quibble about some of these other films where we know more about their story, then we feel like we've been cheated. But when we watch Walk the Line, maybe there's some Johnny Cash fan somewhere fuming and, just angry that their musical hero, got short shrift and we don't even know,
that's a definite thing about those films. That's a definite mathematical fact. It's like the more you know about the person going in to see the film, the more chances you're going to have of being disappointed when things aren't right. But the less you know, then you're more inclined to just go with the story as the filmmakers have presented it. And so, that gets into how much of a fan you are of the person beforehand, or if this is a movie that's going to open you up and then you're going to go do your own research and go back and get the records and go back and read the books and go back and watch the YouTube interviews on television and all that, because the movie opened a window for you and got you interested. So, they work on different levels like that for sure.
Absolutely. I wanted to talk about Bolden. We probably didn't talk about this beforehand, but I kind of threw Bolden in here because it's a movie about New Orleans cornet player Buddy Bolden. It just came out. I don't even know if it's in theaters anymore. It seemed like it came and went really, really quickly because it was sort of like this independent wild card flick. And talk about a collage and kind of a impressionist painting, if you will, about a figure that very few people really know anything about. And so it's a very beautiful film to watch in terms of the composition and some of the more imagined. It does have a sort of fantasy element to it, I would say. What was your impression of Bolden? Because I'm assuming you've seen it.
I saw Bolden twice, and I was very much into it. I gave it a glowing review, and I did a piece where I interviewed the director, Dan Pritzker, as well as Wynton Marsalis, who did the score, and actually played Buddy Bolden's cornet parts and Louis Armstrong's trumpet parts. I was really blown away by the film. It's a tough film for black people to watch because it takes place during Reconstruction, and even though we're free, we are still so under the thumb and the heel of the whites in power at that time. And there's a lot of kind of raw depictions in there that you have to deal with as a black person. And so that was my main thing when I wrote my piece. It's like I wanted to encourage audiences, especially black people, to still go see this movie, but let them know ahead of time two things. One, that it's going to be kind of rough, certain things that you're going to see. And two, it was not really a biopic because, like you said, there, I think there's like five or six known facts about the man. So Dan Pritzker had this wide berth of you know, canvas to just kind of create a story about the time period, about who he felt Buddy Bolden was. It was based on the source material of a book that you know, gave as much information as possible from people that knew him and were musicians at the same time as him and all that sort of thing. And then he had the brilliant way of presenting it surreally by having it be flashback. You know, Buddy Bolden's in an insane asylum, and the woman that runs the place, you know, turns on the radio, and it happens to be the first night that Louis Armstrong gets to do a radio broadcast. Buddy hears it, and it sends him, his mind, on a journey to his life and music, and this music that he started that Louis Armstrong had picked up the torch for and all that. Oh, man. So, yeah, beautiful film. I wanted to take my father to see it, and it would have been my third time. But like you said, even in L.A. here, it's probably still here somewhere. But, you know, even though they spent millions and millions of dollars on that film, private funding, the director himself put his own family money into it. At the end of the day, it was the kind of thing that wasn't going to sit in theaters for very long because the audience is just too small for that. So I'm hoping it does really well on cable and Netflix and DVD, Blu-ray, because it's definitely something that music lovers would love to have in their collection, because it's a beautiful film and it's a very, you know, just a great historical piece to have.
Absolutely. How could I forget that you wrote about it? I read it. Duh. Anyway, but it is, and it's an example of, you know, as you say, it's not a traditional biopic, but it does attempt to give us some information about a real life figure who was really important to the history of music in this country, because we know that jazz is like one of the true indigenous music forms. It was created here in this country by African Americans. So thank
Absolutely.
You for sharing all of that. Yeah. So we've got less than 20 minutes left. So I want to jump to talking about some films that didn't really hit the mark for us. You know, we could have talked about Why Do Fools Fall in Love, La Bamba, Selena, Coal Miner's Daughter, but I'm going to go right to Miles Ahead from 2015, which is a reimagination about Miles Davis. Now, I didn't get a chance to see it. I'll just confess right here, because I wasn't sure I wanted to see it, because it just, the reviews were crazy. It Don Cheadle portrays Miles Davis. He also directed the film, and I guess he's imagining this situation that Miles would be in. I don't even know. What are your thoughts? Have you seen it?
Oh my goodness, yeah. And yeah. So, yeah, this is one of the movies that I talk about a lot of being supremely disappointed in, and it, for many reasons. You know, first of all, my problem with the movie is that it should have been, if it was going to exist in the form that it exists in, it should have been a third or fourth movie that was done about Miles Davis, where somebody wanted to do something that was, you know, what if? You know, what if Miles did? A Miles Davis theatrical motion picture, the first one should have been the real deal Miles Davis story. And I just so don't understand, because if you think about Hollywood and the kinds of things that Hollywood wants to do to put butts in seats, Miles's story has all the – it had sex. It had drugs. It had violence. It had, you know, intensity. It had history. It had – it has everything that Hollywood usually wants. So it's like, why did you have to fabricate this BS story about a 5-year period when Miles wasn't doing anything but being at home recuperating and you know, trying not to be in pain and thinking about what his next move would be, because he is already 10 chess moves ahead of everybody else in jazz, you know? So it's like, you know, for Cheadle to decide, and I read this in print in an interview where he said, I don't want to tell a Miles Davis story from the cradle to the grave or any of that. You know, when I think about Miles Davis, I think about somebody who's a badass. He's just bad. So I'm going to do a movie about a badass dude who somebody steals his music right out from under him in his home, and Miles is going to go back and get his masters. What is it? You know, they stole a master tape. Somebody stole a master tape of his from his home. And so Miles, with gun in hand, goes to the record company and goes, you know, searching for, you know, whoever stole it. And the only good thing I could say about that movie is that there were a couple of flashbacks. Actually, the only flashbacks that worked for me in that film that dealt with real Miles Davis history was the relationship between him and his first wife, Fran. And Francine. That was, you know, they did that part beautifully. But then they had other flashbacks of Miles and Gil Evans in the studio that weren't quite right. And a real horrible one, flashback of Miles rehearsing the great second quintet in the basement of his house. And none of the guys looked like Tony Williams, Ron Carter, Wayne Shorter, or Herbie. The only reason you knew Herbie was Herbie because he had glasses on. You know, it's like they didn't cast the things right, you know. So it was just, you know, I know there are people out there laughing. And all my close friends that were around me when that movie came out, they already got an earful. They probably got 10 earfuls. And so I'm just going to leave it at that. That was one of those movies that just should not have happened when it happened. Same as the Jimi Hendrix movie where they only wanted to deal with 3 days out of his life, or a Nina Simone movie where they wanted to deal with just a certain aspect. Okay, you know, that's some art house stuff that should happen after somebody has done a real movie that deals with who these people are. And that's my strong feeling about all of that, you know. Yeah. I'm gonna stop there.
I just wonder if Hollywood. I just wonder if Hollywood also thinks, well, you know, we can't do these straight biopics on all these people. You know, like every once in a while, we have to try something new. You know, let's try something really out there with these stories. And you know, I was dissuaded from seeing Miles ahead for that very reason, because I love Miles's music. You know, I know his story. He's a fascinating character. Like you said, they didn't have to change one thing. And I remember reading about Don Cheadle doing a biopic, what I thought was a biopic. You know, Don Cheadle does Miles Davis. That sounded really exciting. You know, like, oh, wow, this is going to be cool. And, you know, what a missed opportunity, you know. So,
well, the real quick backstory behind that is that they really wanted Don. The family, you know, was involved with the movie The Estate, and originally they just wanted Don to play Miles. And Don playing Miles Davis is a great concept on paper, and I think that if Don had not been involved in the direction and writing of the movie, if it had been a real pick, like I said before, then he would have been a great first choice to play Miles. He played Miles well, but it's just the context and the way that they chose to tell this spin-off side-to-the-side story about Miles that was so wrong and offended so many people that knew Miles and loved Miles, people that played with Miles. I mean, a lot of people were just really undone. Dick Gregory wanted to rip everybody a new behind that movie. Miles was his friend. He said, how could you guys do this? You know, how could family even be involved in doing a movie that had those kind of elements in it? So, like I said, you know, it's a real sore point for me. It's deep because I know people in the family and I love the family is great, you know, but it was just one of those things where the movie just should not have happened the way it happened. And that's all I can really say.
Exactly. So what about Get On Up, the 2014 James Brown picture? I kind of liked it, but I know a lot of people did not, because it too had kind of a collage kind of a feeling, like these different snapshots of James Brown's life, and we didn't really get the full linear story. We just got like different moments.
Yeah, I agree. That Get On Up, I remember going to see that the day that it came out, and first showing in the morning, And I remember walking away from it being really disappointed in the way, again, that James's story was told, and it was kind of jumping all over the place. And, you know, some of it was actually played for you know, comedically. I mean, it's like, you know, because there are aspects of James Brown that were kind of comical. But I went back and saw that movie two more times in the theater, specifically because I loved the way Chadwick Boseman embodied James Brown. I talked to Christian McBride, you know, who actually knew James Brown, and I said, man, did he get James? He said, no, he wasn't doing, he didn't, like, give you James the way James really was, but the interpretation that he came up with of how he wanted to present James, and it stayed from beginning to end of that film, was riveting. You know, I loved it. I loved the way he played him. And I also loved two scenes specifically in that movie that blew me away. And again, me loving real stuff, one of the scenes I loved, I found out later, did not happen. And that's the scene where Little Richard and James Brown are sitting outside of that hamburger stand, and Little Richard is giving him game about, you know, the industry. And I love that scene. And that's the other, what's the guy's name who passed away? Nelson Ellis?
Nelson Ellis as Bobby Bird.
No, I'm sorry. Yeah,
really
he played
good.
Bobby Bird. But I forgot who was the guy. There's that other guy that played Little Richard and did such a great job. Yeah, I'm forgetting his name right now, too. But, oh, my goodness. It was... that scene was great, as well as the scene with Bobby Bird and James Brown on stage, where they end up parting ways for a while. Those two scenes, I thought, were just some of the greatest black movie music cinema moments ever. You know, just incredible. But movie as a whole was left me wanting.
Exactly. There was so much more and so much left out. And because James Brown was so prolific as a performer, there's just no way to get to all of the songs, all of the, you know, notable performances, all the incidents, all the wives, you know.
Right.
So, so
all kind of history that they couldn't deal with. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and you know, he was the Godfather, Soul Brother number one, and you know, there's so many different eras of James Brown, and that's why I think they did the movie, and then I think the same company came behind and did a documentary. I remember Mick Jagger being one of the producers. You know, put up some money for that. Yeah, and so they were able to tell more of the real story in the documentary form, and then just kind of had creative license to wild out and tell the story the way they told it for Get On Up.
So I think I was going to mention Straight Outta Compton because a lot of people loved that, and I thought it was well done for the most part, except for leaving out the incident with Dee Barnes that Dr. Dre had, and just leaving out some of the women that contributed to their success. But overall, it was well done. But here we are. We got like 7 minutes left, and we didn't even talk about how documentaries, just by their nature, are much, you know, documentarians are much better able to present a more rounded story about a lot of these artists. Because I know, like, you know, even Thelonious Monk, Straight No Chaser from 88 is really good. The Quincy documentary that Rashida Jones, his daughter, just did last year, I thought was phenomenal in showing not only... the Quincy thing showed not only his musical achievements, which I think sometimes people forget how much Quincy did, but also the human toll that it took on his health in producing all of this and being, you know, the pressure to produce all this music and be everywhere and be all things to all people. It was really a lot for him. And then Aretha's Amazing Grace, which I think you initially didn't like so much, and then you kind of came around. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, real quick on all of those, with Straight Outta Compton, just to go back to that real quick, that was that's different from all the other stories that we were talking about, because that is about a group,
And so then you're getting into the Rashomon effect, where you've got four different points of view and, you know, different people and stories to deal with. And so that was problematic for that. And yes, documentaries, you know, definitely have a way of, you know, if you're really into the real history and the depth of things, those movies, when well done, can give you a really good perspective on things. I too love the Quincy Jones piece. It showed you how driven Quincy was, and I think he brought a lot of pressure on himself because he took on a lot of things that he wanted to do, whether it be, you know, scoring films or producing records or being a record executive. And, you know, he wasn't turning down a lot of opportunities because he wanted to do them. And, you know, that man's life and Rolodex and all the people he knows is phenomenal. There's already been, what, that's like the third or fourth documentary on Quincy Jones that I know of, you know. So that cat, you know, it's a whole other thing. And, yes, Amazing Grace, wow. When I first saw it, I had an attitude because, you know, in all of Aretha's lifetime, she did not want the film to come out. So being here in L.A., when they showed it for a week of Oscar consideration, I went with my arms folded. You know, it's like, well, what, let me see what this is. You know, Aretha didn't want it out. I really don't want to support it. But it's here, so I'm going to go see it. And I just had an attitude. I felt like, it, you know, the woman had only been gone a month, and the family signed off and let this movie come out against her wishes, to what I know. But then up a couple months later, I got the opportunity to see the movie at the actual church where it was filmed. And when I walked into that church, I got chills. I wanted to see it again because I was reviewing it. And so I said, you know, let me give it another look. And then so I'll feel better about writing about it instead of just having an attitude about why it came out. Let me deal with the film itself. And so I came away from that feeling like Amazing Grace is not a documentary. It's more of a concert film to me. It has some light documentary elements as far as it documented those recording sessions that took place in the church. So you have, you know, a little bit of behind-the-scenes stuff going on. But it's nothing like a documentary like Quincy Jones or Whitney, which I thought was amazing. And way back in the day, Thelonious Monk, Straight No Chase. I mean, all my favorite music documentaries have multiple elements that make them compelling and riveting and historical, because you're getting perspectives from a lot of different people and a lot of different places. So,
Absolutely.
I tell people, please go see Amazing Grace if you can in a theater. Enjoy it. You know, it's a great slice of Aretha. Just don't call it a documentary. I think it's a concert film. That's just my opinion. It's not when it was a recording session, but it was a concert because it was in front of people. You know, it was recorded live. So that's kind of my take on it.
I appreciate it because, you know, the story of how you turned the corner on that, because I know we have kind of, well, we never fight, you know, we never fight, but we did have different.
No, we
opinions.
Never
like,
fight.
I was kind of surprised. No, we never fight. I was kind of surprised when you were like, no, you know, Aretha didn't want this in the theater and, it, you know, no one should see it. And I was like, oh, okay. So, but
well,
it,
like you
it
said
truly
before, I have
is
strong
amazing.
Opinions. It is.
Oh,
it
absolutely.
Is. And I definitely tell people to go see it, you know, and if you can, see it in the theater because, you know, it'll rock you. But then you'll want to take it home and be able to crank it up on your home system. And, I mean, Aretha, you know, just her singing is such a revelation. You talked about that, you know, like how you realized when you saw Amazing Grace. I think I kind of took Aretha for granted while she was here, because watching this film is giving me a whole nother appreciation for how amazing she was. So that's the takeaway for that film. And you got it 100%.
Yeah, I finally realized she wasn't just a vocalist. She is a musician. So anyway, we need to wrap this up. We could talk a whole nother hour about all these films, and maybe at some point in the future we will. And I know that you're about to do something that I wish that I could do right this very moment. Tell the folks where you are right now.
Well, I am at the Cinemark Theater over here. It used to be called the Rave, and before that it was the Magic Johnson Theater. And we are so fortunate.
In Los Angeles.
Here in Los Angeles, because the day before movies come out, some of these theaters will sneak, you know, a couple of screenings in the night before. So I am about to get my Rocket Man on as soon as I hit hang up on this call. I am in the parking lot as we speak, and I can't wait to see it. And
so
if I really get
jealous, so jealous.
You know,
and
but
we got 30
you know,
seconds, Scott. We got 30 seconds.
Well,
so I'm going to wish you well and enjoy it. Let us know what you think about it. And I so appreciate you coming on the show, my brother. Love you madly.
I love you too. Thank you for having me. I wish you were here with me. I'm going to be hanging out with our girl, Deborah. And but it's not the same. It's not the same, my dear. It's not. But that's my girl, and we're going to enjoy it. And till next time, my dear,
Alrighty. Let's
do this again. Bring me back.
All right. I certainly will. All right, everybody. Thanks for listening to the Words on Flick show with my very special guest, A. Scott Galloway. And I'll see you again in 2 weeks. Have a lovely night. Take good care.